The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is July 15, 2020. This panel of the court today has three cases set for oral argument, each case by video using the WebEx software. This is the third case on today's calendar. The case is, there are two consolidated appeals, A20-367 and A20-368. Consolidated appeals from two district court files in the matter of the welfare of EMH. Before we begin with appellant's argument, I just wish to make sure that respondents' counsel is able to see everyone and to hear me. Ms. Lohr, is that correct?
I can, Your Honor. I can't see myself for some reason. Can you see me?
I can see you. So I think you know, if you should have a feature where in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen you appear. Now, in the upper right-hand corner, there are some options. Little circles there. If you hover your cursor over the upper right-hand corner of your screen, you'll see some options. And I think various ways of seeing yourself, but.
Got it, I appreciate it, thank you.
It works, okay, very good. And, okay, I think we are ready to begin. As both attorneys know, you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments. Appellant's counsel will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. Ms. Ellis, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Deborah Ellis, and along with Susan Johnson, we represent EMH, a juvenile, and he is appealing the adult certification order issued out of the Washington County District Court. In every certification proceeding, the overarching issue is public safety. And would public safety be served by maintaining EMH in juvenile jurisdiction, and in particular, it would be extended juvenile jurisdiction, EJJ. I would like to address first why we are urging this court to reject and reverse the lower court's order for adult certification. Number one is that the court abdicated its fact-finding duty to one party, one advocate. In a serious matter that affects a young man's liberty interests, this is seriously disheartening. The court was required, although it doesn't need to specify its consideration, but it was required to consider six factors in determining whether to certify the matter to adult court. And two factors in particular are to be given greater weight. That is the seriousness of the offense and the juvenile's prior record. Certainly by adopting the state's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law in record speed, the court focused almost entirely on the seriousness of the offense and the allegations. But as has been said many times by this court, evidence of the offenses alone is insufficient to justify certification. So I reflect.
You don't disagree though with the district court's finding in terms of the seriousness of the offense of the offenses, though, correct?
No. I mean, that's a given and accepted. And so then, as in any adult certification, because we're always dealing with an offense that in adult court would be a presumptive commit, as the LM court said, the court must consider non-offense related factors. And as I reflect back to what teachers would tell us, they would say, show us your work. Tell us how.
Ms. Ellis, I think you accidentally muted yourself. Now I.
Am I back on now?
I'm sorry. I was muted.
Oh.
But
oh, okay.
Now, yeah, you were muted temporarily, but now you're unmuted. You may proceed.
Okay, I mean, the pictures went away, so then I pushed a button. I pushed the wrong button. Anyway, so teachers would tell us, show us your work. Tell us how you got there. So you just didn't grab somebody else's words or answer or whatever, that there has to be some indication as to how you reached the conclusion that you did. And in this case, conspicuously absent from the court's order is any discussion about this juvenile at all. And as I have been in the last few days reading numerous certification cases, all of them have a detailed recitation about the juvenile. You know something about the juvenile, where they grew up, what their background is. And in this case, the judge's order, having adopted the state's proposal, merely says he's 18 years old, he has no prior record, and he's been going to therapy. But
Ms. Ellis, first of all, you gave me flashbacks to school when I would do math and I would do it in my head and I wouldn't put it down on paper. So thank you for that flashback there. But I do have a more serious question in terms of what the district court actually needs to provide and present. Is there any requirement that the district court put all that background information in it, in its findings?
I think because it's not in there at all, it should cause this court great pause as to whether the court considered, gave independent, careful consideration to all of the evidence that was presented, including the recommendation from the court appointed, I would say, expert. The court ordered a certification study. A very experienced probation officer prepared the study. It was unanimously agreed by the department for a recommendation for extended juvenile jurisdiction. So it is unusual that a court would reject, I would say, the evidence that was presented in court, the testimony and the supporting certification study prepared by Mr. Burry and his department, and make a determination, I'd say kind of sua sponte.
But it is within the district court's discretion to make findings that the certification study, for example, demonstrates that the juvenile does not demonstrate a potential for success in a sex offender program, which is in paragraph 15 of the findings, and in paragraph 14 in the findings. So there are findings by the district court about this person, not just about the offense. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Okay, yes, those are in there, but those are contrary to what the recommendation and the certification study found, because the certification study found that he's particularly amenable to probation and to sex offender treatment. So those—
Why is that legally important? I mean, it strikes me that the evaluation by the probation officer is used to inform the district court, but the district court conducts its own evaluation of that information that's provided, and based on all of the information that is before the district court, can accept or reject those recommendations. It's within their discretion.
But, okay, so what was before the court, and the probation office had more information, the court had the certification study and the testimony, but the probation officer had school records, the psychosexual evaluation, the empirical data from their YLSI risk assessment. So the court had the certification study, which was fully in support of EJJ, and the testimony of Mr. Burry, who said he had not changed his recommendation in any way, shape, or form, based upon anything that had occurred since.
District court can also, excuse me, counsel, but Ms. Ellis, the district court can certainly accept or reject portions of the study, and the certification study actually explicitly noted that the seriousness of the offense, which is one of the major factors, and his culpability in committing the offense actually supported recommendations for certification.
But in talking about the culpability, the certification study talked about mitigating factors. I think that also in looking at, well, again, it's risk factors, And let's look a little bit at the timing of this entire case. First of all, the allegations were made in, say, November of 2018. For reasons unbeknownst, the petitions get filed in August 2019, 9 months later. He's brought into court by summons a good month after that. And he has remained in the community, has been involved in therapy, has undergone voluntarily the psychosexual evaluation. And now, pending this appeal, everything has been stayed on the judge's order, which was not opposed by the prosecution, that he doesn't present a risk of flight or a risk of presenting or possibly committing any serious offense. So there's was just a wealth of information that was provided about this youth, this individual, including his stellar academic performance, his ability to participate in programming and team sports, karate, his lack of use of any alcohol, drugs, and his aversion to all of that. And so he was motivated to undergo and begin the counseling and therapy, and the therapist reported that he was responding and participating appropriately. Now, the court found that he denied in the therapy that he had done anything wrong, and that's clearly erroneous. That was not in there. The therapist said he's participating appropriately and responding. Additionally, the court's finding on his own that EMH is not likely to succeed in a sex offender program was contrary to what was found in the study. And I'd say that is very similar to what happened in the Christofferson case, which I have cited, and that is when there was a recommendation for a state sentence, a presumptive sentence, the court on its own sua sponte basically said, I don't think this person's going to succeed, and executed a sentence, and this court reversed.
How is that finding contrary to the study? Because that doesn't take into account that particular study doesn't take that into account, and even the
That's very interesting that he could pick at that study, because he's basically saying, and the prosecutor asked on cross-examination, is that risk assessment sex offense specific? And the answer was no, but it's not murder specific or aggravated assault. The finding was that he was at low risk to reoffend. So if he would commit a sex offense, that would be offending. So I think to try and split hairs and say, oh, because it isn't, it doesn't predict whether a person's likely to commit a murder. So to say that it is somehow invalid, the court ordered the study, the probation officer conducted the study pursuant to all its protocol. And if the court, and the court didn't ask any questions, wanted to call into question why probation would use that YLSI and thought that it was inadequate, the court could have asked for additional testing. But it was an independent court-ordered evaluation. It was thoroughly done. All the data was collected. It is, I think, beyond my imagination that there would be a juvenile with a more stellar, squeaky clean record than this young man. And this isn't a case where he has maybe some little shoplifting or minor contacts with the juvenile system. He has had absolutely no prior misconduct of any sort.
Counsel, on that point, you do mention there's certainly a dichotomy with appellant, and part of that dichotomy is all the factors that you and highlight, but we also on the other side we have two very very serious crimes that are presumptive commits, and one can be used as a prior here. This we're not just talking about one crim sex crime, but we're talking about two. So I don't think the certification study took that into account.
Actually, the certification study did, because the probation officer who prepared it said that he had reviewed the petitions, plural, in both cases, had reviewed the police reports, had the benefit of the psychosexual evaluation. And so in every case where there is a presumptive certification to adult court, in adult court, the person is always looking at prison. So if you say—
But to the specific point, one of the factors you look at is the child's prior record of delinquency. The fact that there are two crimes here committed at separate times means that one of them is indeed a prior, and that is not reflected in the certification study at all, that one of these constitutes a prior.
But nevertheless, you still have to, the court never addressed the public safety issues about this individual in particular, and the court is directed to look at the juvenile and not just the offense. And the cases have said that the offense conduct in and of itself is insufficient. So where the court takes no time whatsoever to balance this particular individual's public risk issue, which I say to the court, there is no public risk to public safety with this young man. And this court below did not discuss or give any weight whatsoever to the public safety issues regarding this individual. Briefly, on these two issues, I know that there's been a lot said about the fact that there are two charges, but it should be noted that these are two individuals from this young man's high school. Am I up, or do I, can I still be heard, or?
Yes, I can still hear you. You may proceed. Yeah. Oh, okay. Your time has expired, but I will allow you to finish your point and sum up. Yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, these are two individual females with whom EMH had a social relationship. One he had been in a relationship with for about 2 years, and the other about a month or a couple of months, and they had been dating. So this is different than if we had out there somebody who was preying upon strangers and committing robberies or rapes, assaults.
Counsel, you're not saying that a date rape is any less, deserves any less culpability than a stranger rape, are you?
No, I'm not. But I think that that taking into account the nature of the charges and weighing it against the public safety issues, that it is appropriate to look at what the allegations are in this case. I'm not saying it's not serious. That is a given. It is a serious offense, both of them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ellis. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Ms. Lohr, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I think ultimately, listening to the arguments that have been presented already, and I think what this court is aware, the issue is that appellant is taking issue with the fact, in his opinion, that the district court did not consider certain factors that they weigh heavily upon. That yes, he is an intelligent young man. Yes, he's a good student. He's thoughtful, he's articulate, he has supportive parents. And until these incidences, we have no indication that there was any delinquent acts that he had committed. However, those are not facts that, those are not legal basis for the district court to consider or to rest its decision on. The court did take those factors into consideration when addressing that he is generally a low risk to reoffend generally. However, that doesn't go to what the biggest concern for the district court and for public safety and for this court is, which is his risk to reoffend sexually. And there is nothing in the record for the district court to rely on. I know Ms. Ellis submits to this court that probation had the psychosexual evaluation that was Ms. Ellis set up for her client to to obtain, and then they provided it to probation. However, that's not in the record. That psychosexual is not in the record, and it was not before the court, and that individual did not testify. So what we have in the record is the fact that he's generally a low risk. However, there's no indication in regards to whether or not he's a risk sexually. And that is the biggest concern. The district court analyzed the six public safety factors as required by law, putting the most weight on factors 1 and 3. And in doing so said, the appellant had not met his burden, because it's a presumptive cert case, of establishing that public safety would be maintained by keeping this case in juvenile jurisdiction. And I think one of the biggest reasons is because we have an individual who, as this court is aware, is presumed to have committed these two very serious, egregious offenses, who now is 18 years old and potentially on juvenile jurisdiction could only be monitored for a period of 3 years. The court weighed that. The court said that does not serve public safety. If we are presuming that this individual did in fact commit these offenses, that is not an individual that can be properly supervised and rehabilitated within a 3-year period of time. It serves public safety to have this individual certified to adult court so that there's a longer period of supervision and we can ensure that public safety is in fact served.
Ms. Lohr?
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Ellis made reference to the fact that there was a 9 or 10 month delay between, a time period, I should say, between the incidents and the charging. Is there any particular reason for that that's of record?
You know, Your Honor, I apologize. I haven't looked in. I am not the individual that charged these matters, so I cannot speak as to why there was that gap in time, and I apologize for that.
Okay, thank you.
But ultimately, at the end of the day, the public safety factors were taken into consideration by the district court. As this court's aware, on this presumptive certification matter, the district court only needs to make findings regarding the child's date of birth, the alleged offense, and why they upheld the presumption. And the district court did that. There is not clear error here because the district court has considerable latitude in deciding whether or not to certify a case. And when there are two permissive views of the evidence, the fact finder's choice cannot be clearly erroneous. There are two permissive views.
Ms. Lohr, I have a question about our review. So Ms. Ellis's brief has two arguments, part one, part two. Part one challenges the adoption of verbatim proposed findings. Part two goes to the merits. I'm wondering whether, let's say, even if the argument in part one does not lead us to reverse for that reason alone, still the verbatim or nearly so adoption of proposed findings affect our analysis on the second issue. In other words, do we provide the district court with less deference than we otherwise would under the rather deferential standards of review?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. And I think you can break that first issue up really into two separate analysis. I mean, the first is you could start with, was this so improper? Was there such an appearance of impropriety that we should just reverse it? And that's the Pedersen case. This case is extremely distinguishable from that. In Pedersen, the court adopted verbatim findings of the state, which were ex parte, did not give Pedersen's counsel a chance to even review those findings or an opportunity to submit their own. That's not what happened here. In this case, both parties had an opportunity and did submit simultaneous proposed findings to the court. The most concerning aspect of the Pedersen case was that the court signed off on these ex parte findings and conclusions that were drafted by the prosecution in a post-conviction proceeding where the allegations were serious misconduct by the prosecutor.
I would agree with you, Ms. Lohr, that Pedersen is somewhat off point, but there is other case law that's more directly applicable concerning verbatim adoption of proposed findings, right?
So I think Pedersen goes to
where that's the sole issue in the case, or at least the sole issue in the analysis.
So I think Pedersen goes to the reversal issue. I don't think that's there. So I think we can move on from that analysis. The next would be, does this court need to provide a more thorough review of the court's decision in this case? because of the fact that, and I'm not going to deny that, yes, the court's findings were mostly on par with what the state submitted. However, I don't think that there needs to be a more thorough and searching review in this case because they were not verbatim. The court did make its own additional finding that it put in. It did make edits, and both parties had an opportunity to submit these findings. And simply because the court chose to work off of the findings that were submitted by the state and not from appellant, I don't think takes away from the fact that that was the decision of the district court. So I don't think that that is necessarily appropriate.
Did the district court, at the end, at the conclusion of the hearing, did the district court rule from the bench or otherwise give any hints about how it intended to rule?
No, and I agree with the court that there is case law that indicates that that would maybe be a more preferential way for things to have happened. However, I will submit to the court that the district court had that certification study from probation prior to that certification hearing, then also had the time 2 weeks after the certification hearing to think on his own about how he wanted to analyze the six public safety factors and what his thoughts were after hearing that testimony. And then got those proposed findings from each party. So he did have time. He had 2 weeks to contemplate on his own what his own decision was going to be. The fact that he then used the state's version of proposed findings in order, I think just is what it is. But the fact that he had those 2 weeks to make his own decisions on the matter, and the fact that he added some of his own analysis tells this court that that was his decision, and he has considerable latitude, and its decision should only be reversed if the findings are clearly erroneous, which if you take all of the findings as a whole, there's evidence to support his decision. And because of that, I don't think this court can find that they are clearly erroneous. For those reasons, we are asking that the court uphold the district court's findings. I would waive the remainder of my time unless your honors have any additional questions.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you for your argument. As a matter aside from the merits, I want to applaud you for wearing a headset with a well-placed microphone in front of your mouth. That definitely helps the court hear attorneys better. And so tell all your friends that's the way to do it. Ms. Ellis, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I would urge the court to take a very painstaking, critical review of the lower court's order, given the seriousness of this proceeding. This is a matter that affects the liberty interests of a young man, EMH. And when you look at cases that require clear and convincing evidence, it's those cases that touch upon liberty interests. So this isn't just a calculation and a, you know, as to what child support should be or monetary. This is an extremely serious matter for which the court at the conclusion of the hearing said, you know, it would be helpful if I heard your, you know, your legal arguments, and I'm in no hurry, and let me, you know, think on this, on that issue of it, not in a hurry. It should be noted that this young man has not been detained at all in detention, and he has been in the community functioning extremely well. So,
Ms. Ellis, I appreciate your argument, and I do want to look specifically at paragraph 15 of the district court's findings, which is was not in the state's proposed orders. Paragraph 15 was entirely prepared by Judge Hoffman. And what I would like you to tell me is, what about the findings in paragraph 15, in your view, is clear error and not supported by the record?
Well, it states in there that he has denied delinquent criminal involvement in each of the events in the therapy sessions. That's not true. There's nothing in there.
Well, on page A18, which is page 4 of of the certification study, under attitudes orientation, it says the juvenile denies his actions regarding the current offenses.
That was when in his psychosexual evaluation with Dr. Marston, which is different than the therapy session, he told Dr. Marston he had engaged in consensual sexual contact with the two females.
But it says in paragraph 15 of the judge's order, it is clear from the certification study, which is what I'm referring to, that he has denied criminal involvement.
And whether he admits or denies is immaterial.
And that's a separate issue. My question to you is, what about paragraph 15 is clear error?
That this the court on its own, on some subjective, unbeknownst basis, determined that his likelihood of success in a juvenile sex offender treatment program as a delinquency matter is at best questionable. And there was that is
so isn't that supported by pages 7 and 8 of the certification study, where there's extensive discussion about the possible placements, and the certification study makes a conclusion that the information regarding the placements is not does not support either certification or EJJ?
That is when they're discussing the penalty aspect of it, but in the last analysis of the EJJ, the dispositional options, it talks about all of those six possible options, which include secured facilities and treatment and combinations of secured facilities and treatment. And I would like to also point out when there's been this discussion that maybe there's only 3 years for him to comply in under EJJ. Well, the court should look at AZ, a case in which this court reversed an adult certification on a crim sex one case, and said EJJ is just not a walk in the park. There is, in addition to a juvenile disposition, there is an adult sentence imposed. So that is out there as the threat if the person doesn't comply. So quickly, I want to also say—
I have one other question. Was the district court aware that a psychosexual evaluation had been conducted but not presented to it?
It was referenced in both the certification study. It is one of the listed items that the probation officer had. I also want to point out that the probation officer was provided with the psychosexual evaluation, had the benefit of that, as was opposing counsel. And Ms. Lair also had that, and that it can be seen in her cross-examination of Mr. Burry. And Mr. Burry has like 25 years of experience working with sex offenders. So I think that I would again urge the court to reverse based upon the fact it's not supported by the record.
Ms. Ellis, you were half a minute ago about to say one more thing, and I want to give both all the judges an opportunity to ask their questions. I'd also want to give you a chance to finish your main points of rebuttal, because as you said, this is a significant case with a lot of consequences. So if there is something else that you haven't had a chance to say, I'll give you an extra opportunity to do that.
No, but we stand by our position that paragraph 15 of the court's finding that the court included is not supported by the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent
argument. Judge
Johnson. Well, thank you.
Judge Reyes, yes?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on the point that you made as well. And we certainly do take this serious, and we have gone through this record in detail. And one other area that I want to focus on was actually finding number 11, where, and we haven't talked about this yet, where the court did find that there's a potentially aggravating factor of particular cruelty and enlists all the aspects that support that. That also seems to have weighed heavily on the district court's ruling, and that's in addition to the fact that we have not one but two victims here. Both are crimsex one matters. So I just wanted to confirm, you don't take any issue with the aggravating factor. I mean, I realize that there's you comment about whether the victim could open the door, but there are other aspects of that particular cruelty that are listed there.
We don't agree that there was particular cruelty. And I think that what they've listed as potential aggravating factors are not aggravating factors under the guidelines. Taking a phone away, saying that someone's ugly because their makeup was running, I don't see those as aggravating factors that would be upheld under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines.
And what about while the juvenile was digitally penetrating the victim, she told him it hurt and to stop? That's not part of it?
I don't think that that is beyond what is, part of the offense conduct. You wouldn't say that that is particular cruelty, such as using a weapon, isolating, having a person with their around their children. So of the factors, I dispute that. And again, that was drafted by the state, of course.
Well, whether it's drafted by the state or not is immaterial when it's actually been adopted by the district court. But the district court is actually looking at the whole totality of the circumstances there of how he treated her at that time while he's sexually assaulting her. Why isn't that when you look at all the different things that he said and did and threatened her with, including video recording it and posting it on the internet if she told anybody what happened? In other words, in addition to the assault itself, actually threatening her.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to just defer to what the case law is on, you know, particular cruelty under the sentencing guidelines. I don't think that it would make it.
Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. And the case is deemed submitted. The court will issue an opinion within the time required by law. And I believe that might be 60 days in a case such as this, which is an exception to our usual standard of 90 days.